This is Ashoka Changemakers, brought to you by the Innovate Podcast in collaboration with Ashoka and Arch Street Press. For nearly half a decade, Imran Khan has been leading change and innovation as a teacher in one of the most dangerous schools in the nation, Harper High School in Chicago. His innovative models are now being utilized in other networks in the Chicago public school system and are restructuring approaches to skill acquisition and academic interventions. Imran has received 4 consecutive medal awards for highest student achievement from the CPS Office of School Improvement and was a finalist for the Chicago Drive Award. He is the founder and CEO of Embark, a multi-award-winning post-secondary success program that is using experimental education to change the trajectory of lives. Under his leadership, Embark has grown from 25 students in one school to nearly 460 in 9 different Chicago public high schools.
Imran Khan, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Thank you so much. Really honored to be here.
Now, Imran, I must start from the beginning. You're originally a business major at the University of Illinois. When and why did you decide to move into education?
So my father was a businessman himself. He came from India to the United States and started all different types of jobs, from taxi driver to pizza delivery guy. Finally, he made it as a real estate broker. And I remember going into business school to sort of complete that vision of being an entrepreneur, you know, following in the traditions of my family. But while I was in business school, I was a little bit disenchanted. But really what took place was my mom had multiple strokes while I was in college. And was going into hospice care, and they were saying that she wasn't going to make it. Fortunately, she survived, and she's with us today, still the heart of our family. But it made me really examine much of my aspirations, why I wanted to do the things I wanted to do, what was my desire for being a business success, what is the value of money versus the value of purpose, what's the value of being a business success versus being able to influence people's lives. I ended up really choosing the route to go into education, to be a teacher, to make a difference in the world.
Now, if I may ask a follow-up question to that, you know, coming from an immigrant background, and by the way, I've also grown up in India and I've been here for 26 years. You know, obviously, the idea of success is a big part of what gets drummed into you. Did you have to struggle with that, or if so, what was the struggle as you moved from business to education vis-a-vis the expectations of success that were around you?
So, you know, many of my friends are, any of my friends growing up that were Indian are engineers or doctors. My brother, in fact, is a PhD physicist who's working on fusion in San Francisco. He carries a briefcase that recalibrates its passcode every 10 minutes to a watch that he's wearing so no one can see the secrets. So you can imagine when I knew I was going to do this thing, I had to go to my dad and I would say, hey, I was thinking about changing my major from business to education. And his response was like, you know, beta, whatever you want to do is fine. I've always been supportive and I will continue to be supportive. He said, but just so you know, you are going to be poor. And it's sort of, you know, a very funny thing that Indian immigrant parents do. They love you, but at the same time, they want to make sure you know that this is probably not the route they would have chosen.
Sure. So let me ask you this. What led you to Harper High School, which, you know, someone once called one of the more dangerous schools? How was your experience in the Chicago public school? You know, how did that kind of affect your path going forward? Of course, then we want to hear the story of Harper High School.
Yeah, Harper High School actually is called the most dangerous school in the United States. 29 kids were shot, 8 killed in a single school year. It was documented by This American Life and got that infamous title there. And of course, I didn't quite know that fully when I went to work there. I was interviewing for a bunch of jobs as a teacher, and I met a woman named Liz Dozier, And she has become pretty famous here in Chicago, too. She was on a TV show called CNN Chicagoland, documenting a bunch of intense stuff happening in Chicago, violence and crime and all these things like that. And she offered me the opportunity to come the next day to be interviewed in a group interview. And so I went there, and I thought that the interview process was really interesting, and there was like large groups of people, and I got interviewed there. And then I was offered a job, and I remember driving up to the school that I was given the job before I'd ever been to the school, and I knew it was a Southside school. And so in my mind, the idea of becoming an educator either meant that I was going to work in a low-income school, because I sort of thought, I thought to myself that, you know, I'm joining sort of an army of light, an army of good. So I'm going to spend a few years on the front line, and that would be what I would be able to contribute to the world. And so I was looking for a school like that. And then when I drove up to the school and saw the neighborhood it was in, saw sort of the devastation, all the empty lots. When I entered into the school building, there was like a caged fence, that sort of a caged doorway that separated the upstairs from the lunchroom. And I realized just quite how hard this probably was going to be. And I came back home, took a bunch of time thinking about it, and decided that I was going to commit.
In that committing process, what was your role going to be? Tell us a little bit more about the typical day in the life of, you know, when you were at Harvard.
So I got hired as an English teacher. And so that meant I would prepare and have the capacity to teach my curriculum or some of the stuff there. And I taught 5 classes every single day, have all the grading and this testing and all the other things that I had to do, which is like a teacher's homework, in fact. Every time a teacher gives homework to all 120 kids, they pretty much have that exact same homework themselves, which is a thing people don't realize. And so that basically was a day, 8 a.m. to 4:30 or 3:30 and 4:30, 5:30, 6:30 going on for your homework. And I would do that every day, and had about 120 kids pass through my classroom doors every single day, and had a deep, long relationship built with them. You had to go everything from being able to manage intense classroom behavior so that there was learning actually taking place in the classroom. Had to get deeply involved in many students' personal lives as they shared with you, as you realized the challenges. You started to learn about the gang systems and all the fights and the brawls that would take place in the hallways. You would learn about the gun violence, and sometimes you would be waiting for the class to start and you'd hear gunshots outside the window, or somebody would have been shot maybe around the corner from the school building, or they would tell you to hold students in your classroom because there was a gunfire in the parking lot. That was one version, but then the other version was you would have classrooms full of these amazing, bright, and beautiful humans who were so rich and so funny that would come into your classroom every single day. And even with all this kind of crazy story that everyone hears about, you know, violence and all this stuff, you get this really, really beautiful experience of all this sort of humor and heart and joy, that every day, you know, I knew that I was going to be laughing hysterically, probably crying, probably getting angry, frustrated, but also getting immensely happy. It was a dramatic roller coaster of like full on life at its extremes.
Now, one of the things, Imran, you've been quoted as saying is that poverty is a physical manifestation of an internal lack of experience or internal lack of experiences. What did you mean by that within the context of the South Side of Chicago?
So, you know, I think we oftentimes think of poverty, we think about violence, we think about crime, we think about guns, as these being the problems. And I think that, in fact, they're symptoms in many ways. And when you think about poverty, the root of much of this is not necessarily that people are poor or don't have access to wealth or don't have access to these types of things. What the issue is that when you've been isolated in such a dramatic way from models of success, from opportunity, from work experiences, when you've been isolated from living in a cycle in which you know many other people who have gone to college, are lawyers or doctors or engineers, then poverty truly is like a physical manifestation in many ways of this massive isolation. That it's the isolation that continues to perpetuate this cycle of poverty. Our students who are living in these communities rarely travel beyond a 4-block radius and oftentimes have never seen the lake that's only 3 miles away, have not set foot in grocery stores that you and I would consider common. That those things, those lack of experiences, are dramatically changing their perception of themselves and their place in the world. And if we ask ourselves what is going to be the key to changing outcomes, changing poverty, fighting violence and crime and these things, it's not necessarily gun control at its core. Not to say that that's not an important issue. It is, but at the core, we need to change the way people see themselves, their place in the world, and the way they think other people see them and their place in the world. It's all about how you perceive yourself and how the world perceives you and how all of that sort of functions together and what you think is possible. And what you think is possible and who you become is dramatically defined by what you've seen, where you've been, who you've been around, the conversations you've had. All of that combined defines the fabric of our being and the fabric of our possibilities and the ideas that we end up fulfilling as we live our lives. And until we're going to start making steps to dramatically change isolation and dramatically change access and dramatically change the kind of opportunities our students have until we're able to really connect that, we're not going to make the kind of strides in education nor in poverty that we really need to make.
So, Ibrahim, speak to us a bit about Embark.
So this realization, I think, truly came as I were having hundreds of kids pass through my classroom doors, and I heard hundreds and hundreds of their stories, powerful, beautiful, heart-wrenching, at the same time, you know, really mind-shifting types of stories about what does living in poverty look like in the faces of people who live it every single day. Here I was trying to teach about commas and Macbeth and the canon and ACT testing and preparing students to understand the relevancy of doing their homework and all this, when so much of the way students see the world didn't include a relevancy in their education. The context in which we were teaching our students things and the education we were giving them was quite disconnected. For example, if students had never been downtown and never seen all the different job possibilities, haven't really, they're not looking around and creating their own sort of dreams and expectations for themselves and seeing a wide horizon of possibilities, then you sitting there and telling them that they need to increase their test score from an 18 to a 20 so that they could go to college and they could have this kind of life. In many students' minds, they haven't quite been able to really internalize what that experience is going to be, and they're not really internally motivated to have an idea of like that this dream. What I've learned is you can't really give people dreams. They have to make their own dreams. They have to want their own dreams. They have to sort of design their own dreams. And then people will be able to fight for them. But before you're able to design your own dreams, you need sort of the language. You need the words for your dreams. You need the things that you've seen. You know, our minds remember something like 87% of what you see, but only 6% of what you hear. So in a way, you need to be able to change the way people see the world and their place in it so that they can have the language of the dreams that you need so that they can be intrinsically motivated to push and drive. And so while I'm sitting there in the classroom, and I recognize that so many students were having a hard time understanding things like going into a grocery store and picking up fruit. I remember this story I told once when I was trying to teach morality and from Macbeth about right and wrong and have a big discussion. And I came into the class and I thought, you know, I was going to tell them the story and then we'd have a debate. And I said, hey, imagine if you went to a grocery store with your mom and you were 6 years old and she had your 2-year-old sister in her arms and she was pushing the cart in the grocery store. She was eating grapes from the produce section without paying for them. She just kept eating them out of the bag. Would you think that was right? Would you think that was wrong? Was that stealing? Is that something you would do as a mother in front of your daughter? As a nerdy English teacher like myself, I would be like, oh, wow, we're about to have a really deep conversation about morality. This is going to get interesting. And the conversation actually derailed and became totally about what kind of grocery store was I talking about. That image of picking up grapes and eating them, that image didn't have any context in their minds and they couldn't visualize it. And it became this whole conversation instead about grocery stores, what kind of access different people have, what kind of produce people are getting, and that they had very little familiarity. So in essence, my students kind of were laughing at me because they didn't understand what I was saying and they thought I was sort of being ridiculous. But what I realized in that moment was, here we were, this is sort of an analogy, constantly trying to educate kids in a way that we think they would understand without quite understanding the context in which they might understand. So rather than bringing our perceptions and perspectives and box in which we were trying to teach them to understand what their perceptions and their box was and then really work from there. And so then as I started to realize those things, I started to take students to grocery stores. I started to take them to the University of Chicago. I started to take them to restaurants and theaters and created all those experiences in really intricate ways so that there was a lot of collaboration and a lot of hands-on learning. But immediately, I came back to the classrooms and I started hearing from other teachers that their students' behaviors are dramatically changing. Then we started to watch their data, attendance, grades, test scores started to skyrocket as a result of those experiences. And that's when me and another teacher that was working at the same school started to do similar work together and started to talk to each other about that work and both of us pushing each other to push the other one and our students to start having more experiences. She taught the special ed classroom and I was the head of the English department. And that was the very beginning, the kernel of what became Embark, that access to experiences can dramatically change outcomes for kids. And since then, we grew the program to 3 schools, and now we're in 19 schools. But what it is now a concentrated 3-year experiential education program. So students starting in sophomore year, junior, and going all the way to senior year, and even into their transitional help into post-secondary, they have a concentration of 8 to 10 experiences every single year, going to businesses, universities, theaters, and arts and culture institutions, and having all types of experiences all through the city. And in essence, we turn cities into classrooms, and have students have a large part of their learning be in the real world, hands-on with tons of other humans, and so that they can get a much better understanding of who they are and their place in the world. So we have partners ranging from ballet companies, theaters, the Art Institute, we've got Leo Burnett, we've got Google, we work with a tech innovation hub called 1871, we work with some of the biggest restaurant groups in the city, Boca Restaurant, Green Street Restaurant, Hog Salt, and we work with National Lewis University, Northwestern, University of Chicago, all sorts of institutions basically throughout the city. William Blair, Groupon, all sorts of amazing companies who commit to opening their doors several times a year and hosting really interesting experiences for our students. So the way it kind of works now is like all of these institutions in the city, businesses, universities, theaters, commit to basically creating experiences for our students, and all of Embark's experiences we work with them to make, all of those experiences are designed to build all the skills that you need for college and career success, basically. If you ask yourself, what does it take to become successful as a restaurant manager? What does it take to become successful as a tech entrepreneur? What does it take to become successful as a graphic designer? In essence, the answer is almost always the same. It takes an ability to have grit, to have tenacity, to have self-control, self-discipline, to understand your value and that you have power over your own future, and that you have the ability to do anything. And so all of those same skills are basically, that's the underpinning of every experience that our students have repeatedly for multiple years, everywhere they go. And then on top of that, of course, you layer a fundamental skill that we miss in education, which is learning how to learn. So students will go to a place and in an hour and a half, they will build wooden sail cars and race them against another school. And that is where a student can come into a room and say, look, I don't know anything about building wooden sail cars, but with some instructions and with some help, we can do this in an hour and a half and build something beautiful and then race them. And that is an important lesson for any student or any person to learn, that you can pretty much do anything and learn anything if you put your mind to it.
Today's episode of Innovate is brought to you by Arch Street Press and Genership, Beyond Leadership Toward Liberating the Creative Soul. In this groundbreaking book, David explores the evolution of leadership within effective organizations, recognizing that leadership processes have been evolving into different and more promising practices. To capture this trend, David introduces a new concept and a new word, Genership, the skill set required for the practice of creativity in groups. Genership by David M. Castro, available now from Arch Street Press.
Now, how have you been able to influence, what's been happening in the public schools through your work at Embark?
One of the most important, I think, sort of factors that you can mark as a success for us is that Embark itself has become integrated into the Chicago Public Schools course catalog. So it's an official class in Chicago Public Schools students will receive credit for. And in order to do that, we've had to sort of prove our success over time and then utilize a lot of the policymaking folks and the people who are making decisions in Chicago Public Schools to see our work, see the data, and see the huge impact that it was making in students' lives. And, you know, innately, every educator understands that this is right, that in order for students to really learn, they should be learning beyond the classroom and in the real world. It's one of the richest experiences, and every human, I think, innately understands that. Learning takes place as you have true and real experiences. Think about the first time you ever went to Europe or the very first time you ever went out of the country. You have mind-shifting sort of experiences in there. So that's one of the ways we've been able to really influence CPS. And I think in another way, as the principals are seeing our work while we are working with their students, they're changing the way they teach every one of their kids. You know, they're changing the way they see experiences. They're changing the kind of access to colleges that they're providing their own students. For example, you know, when we were working at Harper, some of the seniors would complain that they only were able to see one university. And after Embark started to do its work, they ensured that the entire school was starting to see four or five. And so now I think what's really interesting is in many ways, experiences in the past 3 years have become highly sought after sort of an idea. In fact, the University of Chicago started to do a lot of massive research on social emotional learning, these things about how do you teach grit, tenacity, and self-discipline, because it's becoming a huge thing in education. And they did 40 years of research, neuroscience and social science and brain science and educational science. And they came in the last 2 years ago, they released another study that basically said experiences are one of the most powerful ways to do that. And so they are now looking at our work here in Chicago, the University of Chicago, as one of the best examples of social emotional learning in the country.
Now, would you tell us a bit about some of the success stories that you've had?
Yeah. The beauty of this work is that it's extremely difficult to be a social entrepreneur, as everyone who's probably listening to this podcast knows. First, the success rate is so hard, and then the hours. But the beauty of it is that you get to have these amazing experiences with these amazing humans. And one of our students, his name is Lonnie Thomas. Lonnie has had multiple felons. He's been shot several times. He has three kids. He didn't go to college, in and out of jail, selling drugs. And if you ask Lonnie, you say, like, you know, from every standpoint, you would look at a person like that and you would say, this is a hazard to society or whatever, and this person should be locked up or put away. But if you ask Lonnie will say, look, this is the only way I know how to feed my family. And so one of the things is he didn't necessarily go to college, but he had always remembered his experiences with Embark, and he came back to the to us and said, look, I want to know if there's another way. He started to join some of our journeys when we were going to a restaurant, and we connected him with one of our restaurant groups, Hog Salt, and they asked him to come and work for free for a day, and he did so, and very quickly after, he was given a position, and now he is earning $45,000 a year. He's been there for a year and a half and has been promoted 3 times and is one of their star employees. He's able to feed his family and do all those things, and he is a huge social media star because he constantly is reporting book reviews and telling everyone about how they have the capacity to do something different in their life. If they reach out to the people around them, they believe in their mentors, and they take action and do whatever it takes to make their life a success, and telling everyone that there's another way. Lonnie is a real inspiration to me. Oftentimes when the hours are getting long, I think about him. I want to tell another story, actually. I had a student, his name is Joseph Jones, and his family was really gang involved and had a lot of really intense challenges. He didn't have a father, but his mom had an aneurysm, and his sister was storing guns. Sister's boyfriend was storing guns in the basement. The cops were informed. They came, took the mom away to jail. As a result, she had an aneurysm, became handicapped. Joseph and his two younger brother and sister were homeless. They were going from home to home. There was abuse. There was neglect. He started to stop going to school, and he would barely show up. And then he got involved in the Embark program, almost primarily because of the fact that we always went to restaurants and we always fed our students. And so he really got involved because there was food and he wanted to eat. And then he really quickly realized not only is there food, but there's all this amazing parts of the world, and there are all these possibilities and all these interesting career pathways and options for me. And he immediately started to come to school, and his attendance started to rise, and he ended as one of the top of his class, and got scholarships to college, and he's now in his last year of university, and he's taking communications class because he wants to be a motivational speaker, and he should be back in Chicago in about a year, and his dream is to take over my job.
Wow, that's quite the story. So a little bit about your experience as an Ashoka Fellow. How has that affected or impacted your work with Embark?
I think there's multiple layers to that. One of them is that on a personal level, you oftentimes are doing really difficult things and constantly as a leader of an organization such as this, you're constantly asking yourself, what decisions are there? What are you missing? What should you be doing? What could you be doing? If the possibilities are endless, in what direction and how much? And you find yourself sort of like, in many ways, becoming isolated in your own thoughts, in your own self. You oftentimes have very few people that you can turn to and ask about certain things. Definitely very few that have been in the same boat as you or that are making the same decisions. And on a very personal level, the Ashoka Fellowship has allowed me to have deep relationships with many other of the fellows who are doing similar work and facing very similar challenges. And we've all connected in such a personal, deep personal way that it makes you recognize right away that you have camaraderie, you have friends, you have people you can share with, you have people you can learn from, you have people you can collaborate with. And that is that alone is a beautiful gift to be given. That's on a very personal level. And then on top of that, of course, there's all the interesting people you're now being inspired by and you're collaborating with, all the other Ashoka Fellows, such as Lennon and, Lennon, who's running the People's Supper, which is a movement across the country to have dinners hosted by citizens everywhere that would help either bridge people from different social, economic statuses and political backgrounds all together to share a meal and not talk about politics, but talk about personal experiences, to build bridges while breaking bread. And so when I learned about that movement with them, it was an obvious connection for me, and I've been hosting some of the largest and some of the most frequent people suppers in Chicago as a result of that work. And then there have been several other folks who I've collaborated with on different projects and learned different things from the other Ashoka Fellows. And then from the Ashoka Fellowship, the Ashoka team themselves, there's been a lot of love and a lot of care, but also a lot of focus on making sure that we have the tools and are learning different things. They put an emphasis on the ability to scale, because when they find you and they're looking for you, they're looking for someone who has a mind towards creating addressing large systematic social problems and with a vision to sort of look at some of that. So in many ways, I've had some really bold ideas to push things forward, but maybe didn't have necessarily the all the confidence and the connections and the community to be able to execute on some of those, or to quite feel bold enough to take it to the next level. And since joining the Ashoka Fellowship, I've been pushing some of those visions for being able to bring experiences and share what we do and a lot of the work we're doing all across the country, and think about that in really unique and interesting ways. And that fellowship allows me to tap a huge network of resources to learn from, to think about, and then to see how things could be different. To have huddles with different social entrepreneurs and hear from them. And then to look at the diagrams that Ashoka has sort of created and their maps about how you can scale and what they've learned about scaling, and who are the different people you could reach out to about scaling and about thinking about these things. And then being able to give me the ingredients and the tools that I need so that I could really take this vision and make it go to the next level.
So one last question. What's next for Embark, and how do you plan to expand, and what could, if anyone's interested, what could they do to kind of partner with you?
When I think about our work here with experiences and I think about our work with Embark, I think beyond dramatically having the capacity to change outcomes for low-income kids in urban areas, I think there's so much more at stake. It has the capacity to change outcomes for students in rural areas, being able to have experiences. It has the possibility to change outcomes for students who come from wealthier backgrounds, because now, instead of being isolated in their sort of cocoons, they are having all these amazing experiences in cultural institutions with other community organizations, with other philanthropic organizations, with other people who are trying to fight social causes. That changes the way they see their possibilities and the roles they choose in their life. And then I see beyond just educational outcomes. If you ask me what is one of the most dangerous, greatest challenges we are facing as a country, I would say it's not the violence, it's not the guns, it's really the divisions between us. It's the deep isolation that separates all of us. And it's the lack of experiences and the lack of a social fabric that is binding us together. So as a result, so many people rarely ever step in the classroom or step in a share a meal or sit at a table with someone who's different than them. And as a result, you get racism, you get hate, you get inequity, you get unfair laws that are created. You get a perception of people based on their limited view of them through whatever they see on the news. And instead, you don't get the true story. So if everybody was able to start utilizing experiences as a core element of how we educated kids, we would start being able to attack some of the most fundamental problems that our country is facing. There are schools in every single community, schools in every single neighborhood, schools all around the country. And if they thought of experiences as being as important as pencils or pens and notebooks, which if you ask me, okay, those are all tools to educate, What is one of the most powerful tools to educate any of us or change who you become? It's experiences that you have. And if we could start leveraging those in all of those communities, not only will we change those outcomes, but we will dramatically change the route of this country. We'll dramatically change race relations and the way we think about one another and the laws we make and the policies we create. At the root of all of our issues, and I think Barack Obama is talking about this now, I think we as a society are truly seeing this after this election, that at the root of our issue is this huge divisions between us. But my point is we need an action plan, and that is that experiences need to be dramatically integrated into the way we educate our next generation. And if we could do that, we have a very good lever to pull to make a dramatic change in the future. So as I think about those kind of things, it makes me say, what can Embark do and continue to do to be able to share our work with other schools, other educators, other social causes? And so, in essence, we are working on building a blueprint and sharing a lot of the work that we do with many other schools. We're getting calls from folks from, I had a call last week from someone from Italy. We're getting calls from different universities, from different schools, from different cities to learn about our work, and we are working very hard to be able to have something to share with them in a blueprint so that they can be able to build this kind of stuff and integrate it directly into what they do. And we're also working with the University of Chicago that released that study on social-emotional learning and developmental experiences to be able to continue to share our work. And since we're one of the best examples of experiential learning in the country, be able to share our blueprint and our map with other people that are interested in doing this work. I've got a couple other things up my sleeve, but I'll tell you about those in the future.
Well, Imran Khan, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us. It's truly been a pleasure, and we at Innovate Podcast wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Everything that you do with Embark and in the world of education, and back in the world around us.
Thank you so very much. It's been an honor. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press for PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.